I call this meeting to order of the Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee. We do have a quorum now, and I would like to know if there's anyone here who would like to approve the minutes for February 6, 2019.
Madam Chair, I move that we approve the minutes for February 6, 2019.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Olgamont. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed? The motion prevails, and the minutes for February 6, 2019 are approved.
Continuous.
That's right. Can't get started on business until Representative Wolgamont is here. So today we have a presentation from the University of Minnesota, who will be introducing their budget. We have several presenters today, starting with President Eric Kaler. President Kaler, welcome back to our committee, and please proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm glad to see you all again. For the record, my name is Eric Kaler, and I have the privilege of serving as the president of the University of Minnesota. And I want to begin by saying thank you for the strong support this committee and the legislature has provided to the university during my presidency. We're grateful for your continued support and commitment to the university, our students, our faculty, and our staff. And I would also like to recognize with us today is the chair of the Board of Regents, David McMillan, the vice chair of the board, Ken Powell, and Regent Peggy Lucas. And we appreciate their attendance and support. This does mark my final legislative session as the leader of the five-campus University of Minnesota system. And it's been my great honor and privilege to partner with you and your colleagues over the past nearly 8 years. What I've seen happen during that time has been nothing short of remarkable, as our partnership has returned great dividends for Minnesotans. Together, we have invested in critical research initiatives that address Minnesota's most pressing challenges. We've worked to keep tuition low for Minnesota's students and families. And among many other accomplishments, we have made key investments in the university's physical infrastructure, and our partnership with you truly fuels Minnesota's future. We're here today to present our fiscal year 2020 and 2021 biennial budget request, a request we believe is reasonable, strategic, and forward-looking. We must maintain and then improve our current levels of excellence in teaching, research, and outreach, which are critical to the success of our state and its citizens. And we must continue to invest in our core operations to maintain high-quality faculty and staff, address the most critical facility and technology needs, and support statewide initiatives. But without your partnership, we simply cannot maintain the quality and excellence Minnesota taxpayers expect from their public research university. Chair Bernardi, members of the committee, our request for the next biennium is $87 million for our base budget for core needs and priorities. That total includes $30 million in the first year, $30 million in the second year, plus an additional $27 million for an ongoing appropriation following biennial math of $87 million. We're not asking for funding for special programs, new projects, or state specials. Our request is indeed, we believe, restrained and reasonable, focused only on the operational essentials that allow us to deliver on our mission. This afternoon, we'll walk you through the specifics of the request in a way that gives you the chance to hear from members of the University of Minnesota community directly. And at this time, I'd like to turn things over to Senior Vice President Brian Burnett, who will walk through the request with you, Madam Chair.
Okay, and welcome to our committee, Brian Burnett. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I am the Senior Vice President, Brian Burnett, of the University of Minnesota, and it's my great privilege to be here to present our request to you. As President Kaler noted, the foundation of our request is to address our most pressing needs. Different from recent years, we are not asking for a list of unique programmatic or service initiatives that might add to our current portfolio. Instead, we are asking for one item: an increase in our base that will allow us to address priorities across our basic foundational mission activities. You'll note this request is over $60 million less than our request in the last biennium. We did this purposefully to demonstrate the critical need to fund our core basic needs to keep the university strong. The largest component of our request surrounds attracting and retaining the best faculty and staff. 60% of our expenditures at the university, and therefore 60% of this request, is for our people. And I would submit to you that our people are our most important resource. Our faculty, our researchers, our support staff, and the workers who keep our facilities clean, serve our students meals, greet them around campus with a friendly face, and spend their work days helping our students succeed in their short time we have them on campus is critical to the future of the university. And candidly, the competition around the country for the best faculty and staff is fierce. In the College of Science and Engineering, they have recently lost 4 faculty members in the departments of electrical and computer engineering and computer science to other institutions who offered more competitive salaries. In our College of Veterinary Medicine, 4 recent departures were lured to Michigan State, Colorado State, and Tufts, all for pay increases that were significant. This competition isn't confined only to faculty positions. Similar scenarios play out in staff support positions, with particular difficulty in recruiting and retaining employees in technology services, financial services, and health and safety compliance. We attract the best students from Minnesota to come to our university. We believe we owe these students an opportunity to learn and train with the best faculty and staff we can. This budget request before you helps us accomplish that goal. Secondly, support services for students is an area of continuing focus for the administration, particularly President Kaler's leadership. This budget request also provides support to the highest priority needs across all of our units in program areas as well as direct service delivery. One such example of critical support services that students need to succeed and graduate on time includes disability resources, guidance counselors, and mental health services. In fact, a significant percentage of incoming students now arrive with a pre-existing mental health diagnosis, and the growth in students seeking counseling has been increasing annually for us at a rate of 25 to 30%. This is a significant challenge we must and can address with your help. We want our students to succeed when they come to the university. We want them to graduate in 4 years, and this request will help us continue in those efforts. The remainder of our request supports basic technology services, facility needs, and select statewide initiatives. These will be determined through our annual budget process at the university as we continue to work through this in consultation with the legislature. The most pressing priorities in this category are in the need of classroom and equipment maintenance, compliance with federal and state regulations, research and technology infrastructure, maintenance of our core facilities, and support for key activities throughout the state currently facing financial challenges. With your permission, Madam Chair, I would like to now turn it over to Simran Mishra, a student at the University of Minnesota, to talk more about the impact of this request on affordability for our students. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Burnett. And welcome to our committee, Simran Mishra.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi and honorable members of the committee. My name is Simran Mishra, and I'm a senior studying finance at the University of Minnesota, Twin Cities. I have the privilege of representing over 30,000 undergraduate students as student body president at the University of Minnesota, Twin Cities. I'm from Golden Valley, Minnesota, which means I grew up 15 minutes away from the Twin Cities campus. Most students would want to go as far as home for college, but not me. I knew in middle school that the University of Minnesota is where I wanted to pursue my degree. Why? The promise of a world-class education at an affordable cost. The University of Minnesota is known for its renowned faculty, cutting-edge research, innovative academic programs. This is what attracts students from every corner of Minnesota to our university. So today I'm here to talk about how our university's budget request helps keep the university affordable and accessible for all Minnesotans. Students recognize that the relationship between the state and the university is intertwined. State funding is essential in supporting the university's core needs, such as retaining the best faculty and maintaining top-of-the-line resources. Not to mention, for every dollar that the state invests in the University of Minnesota, $13.83 is returned to the state's economy. Nevertheless, our state's share of the cost of university education has been decreasing. As this coverage has reduced, tuition has made up the difference. In 1990, students paid 25% of the cost of education. Today, Not even 30 years later, students pay 58%. This is a very significant challenge for students and higher education overall. We're having a harder and harder time keeping up with the cost of education. The university has strived to keep tuition low for Minnesota residents, particularly on campuses in Greater Minnesota. We are incredibly thankful for these efforts by President Kaler and the Board of Regents. But this simply isn't enough. We as a university and as a state must do more. The budget request before the legislature will help keep any tuition increases at a minimum. But if this request is not met in its entirety, our university will face a very difficult choice. Do we raise tuition rates at or above inflation in order to maintain the current scope and quality of programs? Or do we reduce the breadth and depth of the university's impact but maintain quality? Or do we maintain the current scope of the university's work but sacrifice the quality in key areas of our institution? So in essence, we would need to sacrifice either affordability, scope, or quality. None of these are good choices for students or our state. For that reason, I'm here to ask you to fully support the university's budget request because it will ensure that our university remains strong, which in turn ensures that the state of Minnesota remains strong. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, Ty.
Thank you very much, Ms. Mishra. Okay. President Kaler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Simran. Our commitment to continuing to increase college affordability and access for all Minnesota students does remain steadfast. The University of Minnesota continues to be a leader in recruiting and retaining students from underrepresented backgrounds, a core priority of my presidency, and this request will help support that continued work. I'm an engineer, so I'll give you some numbers. System-wide, for fall of 2018, more than a quarter, or 26%, of our incoming freshmen identified as first-generation college students. For fall 2018, the undergraduate student bodies of three of our five campuses are comprised of at least 24% students of color, one-third in Rochester, followed by Morris at 30% and the Twin Cities campus at 24%. University of Minnesota Crookston continues to emphasize growing the number of students who are first generation from low and middle income families and from Greater Minnesota's rural communities. For fall 2018, Crookston enrolled the highest proportions of first-generation college students in the university system at 47% of the incoming freshman class. At the innovative University of Minnesota Rochester, there is no achievement gap, thanks in part to educational practices that create belonging and peer accountability, including UMR's highly successful Health Corps, a living, learning community of respect and empowerment. Health Corps is targeted to underserved students who are Pell-eligible, first-generation college students, or students of color. Health Corps students' mean GPA is higher than that of their peers, as is their persistence towards graduation in 4 years or fewer. The tuition waiver for American Indian students at the University of Minnesota Morris, coupled with Morris's rigorous, engaged learning environment and strong student outcomes, positions the University of Minnesota to continue to make significant contributions to address the critical educational opportunity gap for Native American students. Morris currently serves 312 Native American students, an increase from 171 students in 2008. Native American students, just 1-2% of higher education students nationally, now comprise 21% of Morris's degree-seeking students. In fall of 2018, the University of Minnesota Duluth launched a new student success coaching program called Maximize You. It's designed to address the needs of students who are at a higher risk for attrition, and it's grounded in a positive psychological approach, focusing on what's right with students rather than on a deficit model that focuses on what's wrong. And since the beginning of my tenure as president, our Twin Cities campus has increased its ethnic diversity from 18.5% to 24.3% of the incoming freshman class. And in terms of headcount, the number of students of color who enter our university as freshmen has increased by 46%. But it's not enough to just have a more representative student body at our university. We need to give all students opportunities to stay the course, to learn and grow, and to ultimately obtain their degrees and thrive. The university's administration and I are acutely aware of the disparities in educational outcomes for students of color and Native American students, and the need to keep working to actively mitigate these disparities by providing greater academic support. We have accomplished much over the past 8 years to make the university more accessible for all Minnesota students, but we can do more. And our base request will help us make that kind of progress we can all be proud of. This budget request is also critical to continuing our work to produce discoveries that create cures and treatments, generate the tools necessary to sustain and grow our agricultural sector, and work to solve some of Minnesota's most vexing problems. I'd like to show you now, Madam Chair, this one-minute video, I promise, 1 minute, highlighting just a sample of the work your state funding supports at the University of Minnesota.
You know the University of Minnesota, but do you really know what the U of M does for you? How these U of M ecologists are enlisting everyday Minnesotans to fight invasive species? Or how these educators are helping our farmers become even more successful? Join us as we take you on a journey across this great state to show how our daily discoveries affect your daily life. From a grassroots attack on the opioid epidemic to using a robot for earlier autism detection. From her rural retail revitalization to his major breakthrough in cancer treatment. We'll share the stories that bring the drive to discover straight home to Minnesota's doorstep. Take discovery to the next degree.
Madam Chair, committee members, I'd now like to welcome Dr. Stephen Guy from the Department of Computer Science on the Twin Cities campus to present a faculty perspective on our request.
Thank you, Dr. Guy, for being here.
Thank you.
May I proceed?
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the chance to address you today on the role that research plays at the University of Minnesota and how the university's budget request supports this work. As introduced, my name is Stephen J. Guy, and I'm an associate professor at the University of Minnesota in the Department of Computer Science and Engineering. In addition to teaching, I'm a researcher in artificial intelligence, also known as AI, a field that challenges us to find ways for computers to generate human-like insight and decision-making automatically. My research focuses on application of AI to robotics, computer graphics, and medicine. As a tenure-track faculty member at an R1 university, research university, I have the unique opportunity to incorporate my research experience into my role as an educator in order to train the next generation of leaders in research and technology. This responsibility to train new researchers is particularly critical at UMN because we're the only institution in the state equipped to fully train students on the rapidly developing frontiers of knowledge needed by a next-generation workforce. At the U, this research-based training and education happens at all levels, including both graduate students and undergrads. Today, I wanted to talk about the role that undergrads play interacting with the research at UMN. Undergraduates benefit directly from these research activities in many ways, including access to highly advanced specialized courses that are taught by the people who are in the field making the advances. Additionally, many of our undergraduates engage directly in new research, actively participating in and often leading many of the research projects around the U. In fact, the university is currently financially supporting over 700 undergraduates in the Twin Cities campus alone, and many other undergraduates are engaging in research through independent studies and advanced coursework. Importantly, the undergraduates engaged in this work are learning topics that can't be found in any textbook. Instead, they're creating brand new knowledge through the research process. As an example, many senior undergrads take my advanced motion planning course, having no previous research experience. But by the end of the semester, they're reading and implementing recent research papers, and in some cases, even developing their own new algorithms and technologies that didn't exist when the semester started. It's really fun. This is only possible because students have access to state-of-the-art hardware, software, faculty, and graduate students who are full-time researchers in the same courses actively participating with them. My students from these classes and others like it have gone on to work in exciting problems relating to AI, graphics, and robotics for many of the most selective high-tech companies, including Google, NVIDIA, Facebook, and Apple, or have continued to develop their research skills as master's and PhD students in top universities, including here at the U, where they become experts in their field. I feel really lucky that society at large is increasingly appreciating the importance of these research areas and the roles they have in our future economy. For example, my own work on simulating the dynamics of human motion in crowds was profiled in the Boston Globe and featured in an Australian public radio documentary. This work is now being used to design safer buildings and help avert the risk of future crowd disasters. My lab's collaborations with psychologists and surgeons on trying to analyze the key dynamics of what makes human smiles look genuine and engaging has been widely covered by the international media and press, and was actually even highlighted on Late Night with Seth Meyers, which is certainly a highlight of my research career. This work is leading to new insights that may improve facial reconstructive surgery, lead to better digital avatars, and even increase our understanding of issues and diseases like autism and other sort of issues with emotional expression, processing emotional expressions and faces. In the process, this research has been ongoing and is very exciting, and we're recruiting many undergraduates to lead and continue this. In the process, the undergraduates are gaining very specialized expertise in machine learning, motion planning, and computer graphics, and other technologies that will be needed for jobs in emerging fields like self-driving cars, artificial intelligence, and robotics. Madam Chair, the university's budget request supports work like mine and thousands of others across the institution. As a faculty at the U, I feel a deep responsibility and privilege to prepare students not only for the jobs of today's top companies, but to give them the abilities to create the next Medtronic or Cargill or General Mills. As researchers, teachers, and mentors, our goal is not just to train the next generation workforce, but to give our students the skills they need to build new industries that barely exist today, and the tools of discovery and innovation needed to build Minnesota's future economies. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Is it Professor Dr. Guy, or how do I give you your credentials? Okay. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair.
Yes. Representative Runbeck.
I could. Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Guy, I wanted to just ask you about the size of the computer science department and maybe the engineering department. Are those departments, in terms of the size, the number of students that are being served, are they expanding? Are they status quo, or are they going somewhere in terms of the trends?
Dr. Guy.
Thank you. I don't have the exact numbers with me, but the trends are growth. Every semester, we've had several percentage growth year after year, and this has continued every year I've been at the university, and my understanding was there before I came.
Okay. Madam Chair, do you have the student numbers at this point?
Dr. Guy.
I can try to get them with you. I don't have them with me right now. There's several hundred students in our department, and more that are pre-majors engaging in our department as undergraduates, as graduate students. The class I'm teaching this semester has nearly 200 students in it as an introductory computer science course, and there's three other introductory courses of similar size happening right now.
President Kaler?
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Perhaps I can give a little more color to Professor Guy's response. The College of Science and Engineering roughly has about 7,500 undergraduates and a few thousand graduate students. It's one of the largest colleges on the Twin Cities campus, but it is also one that is bottlenecked in many regards. We have far more qualified students in computer science and in particular, but several other disciplines than we can accommodate, and we have many industries and other avenues waiting at the other end of that pipeline to hire those students. So one of the college's priorities is actually to grow that pipeline. It's constrained by resources and by space. So the legislature approved the renovation of Pillsbury Hall, you may recall, the iconic building on the Twin Cities campus. When that's done, that will allow consolidation of the English department, vacating a considerable amount of space in the engineering complex that will be repurposed for growth. That will solve the space problem. We continue to request funds in this core mission that will help strengthen the core mission of CSE. The board approved a tuition surcharge for CSE students that will bring additional resources that will allow us to grow the program. So we are acutely aware of both the supply and demand parts of that equation and are working hard to grow the pipeline between the two.
All right, thank you
very much. And President Kaler, do you have another testifier?
I am going to bring back one you are familiar with, okay. Senior Vice President Burnett.
Proceed, Mr. Burnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd just like to also just briefly talk about our outreach mission, the third part of the tripartite mission of the University of Minnesota of education, discovery, and outreach. The most obvious example of our outreach is Minnesota Extension, serving all 87 counties across the state. Our extension researchers and educators engage individuals and organizations in asking the challenging questions to discover science-based answers that make a difference in our daily lives, from animal care to community development to crop production. This request supports these outreach efforts. And you've seen our faculty and experts in your committee hearings almost daily since the start of the legislative session. In fact, to date, the House and Senate have invited nearly two dozen different University of Minnesota faculty, researchers, and personnel to the Capitol to help you and your colleagues better understand the issues that they will discuss this session. And this doesn't include members of our government relations team, or me, or President Kaler. They've helped set a baseline in understanding in areas like early childhood education, aquatic invasive species, net neutrality, chronic wasting disease, health care, and many, many others. Much of this work was highlighted in the video that we showed you earlier. We are proud of their work, and we are honored that you, the legislature, continues to look to your university to help you better understand and hopefully solve Minnesota's greatest challenges. And this budget request before you supports their important work. Thank you again, Madam Chair.
Yeah, thank you. Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a question on the outreach across the state photo here that you have of the state of Minnesota. And I actually represent the city of Austin that has the Hormel Institute, which is the University of Minnesota Research Center. And I'm just wondering if there's a triangle missing on the map, or is that not something that you would consider a research and outreach center?
President Kaler.
Madam Chair, Representative Hoppe, that is a really good question, frankly. It is not a regional extension office. It is a component of the cancer center and therefore the medical school. So it would probably most nearly fall under the cities with U of M healthcare training sites, but it is also, to use an overused word, unique, and probably we need another symbol to recognize that, and we will update our map.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Good catch, Representative Poppy.
Very good eyes.
Yeah. You know, she's advocated for that facility a lot and has shared with our members about the great work that they do there.
It is a very strong component of our medical discovery work, and their work on nutraceuticals and natural products is extremely significant. If I may continue briefly, Madam Chair, overall this request is about maintaining and then improving our current levels of excellence in teaching, research, and outreach, which are critical to the success of our state and its citizens. The University of Minnesota is a place where education not only transforms the life of the student, but it provides the student with tools to go out into the world and impact the lives of thousands, if not millions, of others. As we have described to you this afternoon, we must continue to invest in our core operations, maintaining high-quality faculty and staff, addressing the most critical facility and technology needs, and supporting statewide initiatives. To simply maintain our current scope of activities, we must address inflationary costs related to personnel, including health care benefits, and our infrastructure. Madam Chair and members of the committee, it's absolutely critical that we maintain the current scope of our programs consistent with the priorities of the Board of Regents elected by you, the state legislature. But without your partnership, we cannot continue the quality and excellence that you, your constituents, and all Minnesotans have come to expect from their public research university. And I would conclude with presenters, and I am scheduled to present two of our students to address the committee, Holly St. Clair from the Twin Cities campus and Sierra Brown from the Morris campus. Unfortunately, Ms. Brown's travel attempts were thwarted by winter weather, but Ms. St. Clair is here, and I would invite her to the microphone.
Okay. Welcome to the committee, Holly St. Clair. And as we're waiting for you to approach, I just want to thank Ms. Brown for not coming. We, her safety is much more important, and send her our best wishes, please.
We will indeed.
And if she wants, if she has a written testimony, she's welcome to present. She's welcome to send it to the committee.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And welcome to the committee, Ms. St. Clair.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi and members of the committee. My name is Holly St. Clair, and I'm a senior at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities studying English literature, history, and political science. In deciding where I wanted to attend college, I considered a variety of factors. I grew up in South Minneapolis, so naturally my first instinct was to want to leave the Twin Cities and get away as far away from home as possible. After looking at all of my options, I came to the decision that the University of Minnesota was the right option for me. A personalized education experience was something that was important to me when selecting where I wanted to go to college. The University of Minnesota Twin Cities Honors Program offered me exactly the type of experience I was looking for. The program offered an overwhelmingly supportive faculty, high-quality course offerings, and the autonomy for me to explore my interests and build a degree package that best fit my interests. During my time as an undergrad, I've learned that the faculty you work with can make a big difference in future connections and the type of research available to you. And that is why this legislative request with a focus on supporting our faculty and students is so important. From the history and English departments, I have worked most closely with Professor John Watkins. He has encouraged me to do a deep dive into 14th century English literature and history in relation to the formation of law and heresy. An instructor in the English department, Eric Dagg, has offered many service learning classes in which I have been able to spend time in the Minneapolis community while also working on texts that connect to our class learning. This would not be possible without the assistance of the Service Learning Office that supports students and volunteer organizations in making these connections. Choosing the University of Minnesota has given me the opportunity to continue to be active in the community I grew up in. I've had the privilege of being a girls' high school hockey coach for the past three seasons and working with girls from South Minneapolis. Not only has it been immensely rewarding for me to coach the girls on the ice, but I have also had the honor to work with a number of them on their college applications. Of the 15 graduates of the team in the last 3 years, five or more have ended up at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. I found myself being able to speak to the advantages of a big university that I never thought of before. My experience, while meaningful to me, is not unique in practice. Many of my college friends who are from Minnesota continue to stay involved in their local communities. I think this speaks to the strength of the University of Minnesota's land-grant mission. It's been extra meaningful to me to get to stay involved in the things that have been an important part of who I am as a person, while getting the experience of the University of Minnesota. I'm not sure what my next steps are in regards to immediately following graduation, but I plan on going to law school in a year or two and focusing on a career in public service. I'm very interested in public defense and spent the past summer working at Hennepin County Courts. The connections and education I have received from the University of Minnesota mean that although I'm unsure of what comes next, I'm not at all worried about finding a job because I know the excellence of my degree, along with the strength of the University of Minnesota Alumni Network and other resources available to me as a graduate will be of great help. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Ms. Sinclair.
Madam Taylor. Madam Chair, to conclude, and members of the committee, we have a track record of working together as responsible stewards of finite state resources. We've accomplished great things together, and I'm confident that that will continue. As I reflect on my time as university president, I'm grateful to have worked with you and your predecessors. As I prepare to step down from the presidency in just over 4 months, I feel confident in trusting the care of the university's partnership with the state of Minnesota to you and to my successor. I thank you for your continued support of the state's public research university and your commitment to future success together. And with that, we would be happy to field questions from you all. Madam Chair.
Thank you, President Kaler, and I want to thank you for your service to the University of Minnesota and to our state. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Representative Lean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate you being here, President Kaler. Appreciate your service to the university and the state and your tenure as president, and I'm not exactly sure who best can answer this, so certainly anybody feel free to jump in. I understand your scheduled tuition increase is 2% over the next two academic years, over this biennium.
President Kaler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Lean. Our schedule for a tuition increase in partnership with the increase in state support would be 2 to 2.5% a year during the biennium. That would raise a total of $34 million in partnership with the $87 million. That would cover our estimated cost increases and investments over the next biennium.
Okay, Representative Lean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So then would it be fair to say without those tuition increases it would be $34 million each year of the biennium that you would need to replace that, so 68 34 each year, 68 over the biennium?
Representative Chair Bernardi, Representative Lean, I was not clear because of the vagaries of biennial math. It's a $34 million increase over the biennium, so essentially a third of that each year. A third the first year, getting it the second year, and an additional third in the second year.
Representative Lean.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for that clarification. And I also want to touch a little bit on some of the reallocations that the university has been doing. I believe $90 million over the last 6 years. And I do see some information in here. I appreciate that, where the money's coming from and just what that represents in terms of percentage of tuition, percentage of state dollars and everything. Do you have information as to where exactly the money is going? Is it into new academic programs, into new administrative support for expanding other programs? Is it going directly into tuition to help buy that down a little bit?
President Kaler.
Chair Bernardi, Representative Lean. The answer is a little bit is yes to everything. So the reallocation process I characterize a little bit like trying to get pieces of fat out of a really good steak, which is marbled with those opportunities. And so you have to go surgically, and we have a process of reallocation where we assign reallocation targets to the budget leaders, deans and center leaders, and tell them that we expect a reallocation of a certain amount of money. That money is then available for reinvestment to higher and better uses. The classic example I've probably given this group before is early on in this process, we employed three people whose job it was to answer the telephone at the university if you dialed zero. Well, the number of people who dial zero is asymptotically approaching zero, so those people were underutilized. We eliminated those positions, those people separated from the university, and we used the savings to reinvest in a technology specialist to help faculty members create online content as they move their courses into the internet age. It's a great example of using money for a higher and better use. The other way to look at this reallocation is that if we had not reallocated those $90 million and used them for these things that we believe are of high and valuable use, we would have had to ask our students for tuition increases to generate that $90 million. And that, in the documents I believe you have, is illustrated in that if but for those reallocations, we would have had larger tuition increases. So the influence of reallocation, constantly focusing on cutting off the things at the lower end of your priority list and reinvesting in the things at the high end, is an essential element of how we manage the university, and it does enable us to steward our resources and minimize our need for tuition increases.
Okay, Representative Cleavorn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. President Kaler, this is a piggyback question on the reallocation. So having worked in organizations where we are required to force rank individuals, mm-hmm. every group is told you have to rank your individuals and then the bottom gets cut. Well, you and I probably both have seen teams that were filled with great people, and because of forced ranking, we had to lose good people. And we've had teams that were just all, like, probably not the most productive, and many of those staff remained. So when I'm looking at the reallocation of the administrative expenses that have just been outlined for the last 2 years, I hear the question of, I'm asking departments to make cuts because we need money, right? But when I'm looking at the pieces, you know, reduced funding for residential life, and it's $85,000. Now, that's just something I picked off the page. I don't know if that was a good cut or a bad cut. But the real question that comes to my mind is not, are these dollars all necessary cuts, but are you getting the resources that you truly need? I understand you're asking for $87 million. When I first saw that number, I went, that's it? That's all they're asking for? It seems low to me, considering the size of the institution that you were responsible for. So if we set the question aside about are these right or wrong, do you honestly believe that $87 million is the number that you truly need to run the quality institution that we all believe the University of Minnesota is? I will answer that question, and I don't think it is. I think it's a forced number, because maybe that's all we'll get. But I just find it to be very hard. I'm running around the Capitol looking for money for the university, and when I'm looking at these costs that are cut, it makes me very nervous that our students aren't really getting the services and care and attention that they need, and that the institution that we've come to revere is being handicapped.
And so, President Kaler, before you answer that question, is there a page that we all can, like, look to?
So if you go to Section 5, I was looking at the reallocation of fiscal year 2018 administrative expenses and 2017 reallocation of administrative expenses.
And it's not numbered. Does it have
The page is not numbered. But, so.
Tab 5.
The spreadsheet.
And the first
I'm
page
like
of
in the middle.
Okay.
Sorry.
But it's tab 5.
Tab 5 in the middle.
And then there's a spreadsheet.
Yeah. And it'll say fiscal year 2018 reallocation of administrative expenses, $11 million. And then if you go to 2017, it says $14.8 million. And the pages in between, when you just look at them, you're looking at what's being reduced. Information systems, employees, associate dean appointments. I mean, the cost that you're cutting, I'm not saying that they're right or wrong. It just looks like we have this idea that the University of Minnesota is going to be a stellar flagship institution forever. But if we keep cutting and cutting and cutting and cutting, is that really going to be the remaining entity? That's the question I have.
Okay, President Kaler.
Thank you, Chairman Bernardi, Representative Kleber. I'm torn in my formulating a response to that answer. Part of me wants to say thank you very much and yes, please give us as much money as you can find.
Yes.
I don't think that, however, is the responsible answer that as a steward of state resources I should give you. So our balance is affordability and excellence, and those are equally important. We will not make a cut that diminishes the excellence of the university. Will we make a cut that we believe represents a job now being done by four people that we think can be done adequately by three? Would we make a cut of four people to three people because we've added new technology, as we've just done in our travel business, that we think takes manpower needs out of the organization? Yes, we will. Will we ask deans to look carefully at their academic programs and see if they need as much administrative support given the current load of students compared to what it was a decade ago? Yes, we will. And those cuts are the product of that kind of very careful analysis and then reinvestment of those dollars into what we believe are higher and better expenses that drive the excellence of what we want to do. We have worked hard to create what we think is a realistic but hard-nosed budget of $87 million, but we couple that with a request to the board, which has not been made nor approved yet, of a tuition increase that would bring our total to $121 million of new money over the biennium. We believe that is enough for us to continue working lean and working hard and working as efficiently as we can, because I expect that is what is expected of us by the people of the state of Minnesota and by you as their elected representatives to maintain excellence. Our medical school, we've made substantial investments in it. This legislature has made investments in it. And last night, the national rankings have come out, and the medical school rankings improved from 33rd to 30th in the country, a jump of three spots, which is remarkable. Our law school has undergone substantial budget reductions in recognition of the decline in demand for lawyers across the country, and it has maintained its position in the top 20 of law schools in the country. So I believe we can maintain excellence and do it in a fiscally responsible way. That's been my commitment for the past 8 years, and that's what this budget represents.
Okay, yes. Representative Cleburne.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I know that the question I asked you was a really hard question, and I realize that it put you on the spot as well. I just want to make sure that as we as legislators look at those dollars and those budget numbers, that we are truly doing what's right for the University of Minnesota. And I certainly don't want to be labeled the tax and spend liberal, right? So there's that piece of it. But I just want to make sure that we're not just doing what's good enough. We're doing what really brings honor to the people who built the institution over the years. So thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chair, may I?
Yeah, Ms. President Kaler.
Madam Chair, Representative Claiborne. I appreciate that. And our goal, as I say, is to balance this in a fiscally responsible way. Do I think additional investment above and beyond what we've asked for would be a wise thing for the state of Minnesota? Of course I do. But we have created a budget at $87 million that we bring to you not with a plan of bringing you a $300 million request and being happy to get 100. We're bringing you an $87 million request that is $87 million that we need to maintain the institution at the level that you and I want it to be.
Thank you. Okay. Representative Nornes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't have much to add to the conversation except that I truly appreciate the ability or honor that I had working with you as the chair of this committee for a few years. And I remember attending your inauguration ceremony.
A long time ago.
It's very memorable to me because I couldn't find it. I stopped two people on the street. One didn't know where it was either. The other one said, I just got here. So two people were, so, but I did get there. And I remember most of your speech, and it was very good. And I think what you talked about probably has come true, or you were, I think, laying out a pretty good agenda for the future and asking the faculty to follow. And so the only other thing, I was looking at the map. I don't want to dwell too much on the map, but where is the Itasca Research Facility on this map? I'm not sure.
Well,
President Kaler.
So maybe it isn't supposed to be.
Chair Bernardi, Representative Nornes, I'm tempted to tell you it's at the head of the Mississippi, but you might not appreciate that answer.
Somebody, I'd like sure to write the river in here, too. So
It very much certainly should be on there as a research and outreach center, but yeah, we have enough questions about our map today that I'm going to send it back to the Geography Department for tune-up.
I only mention it because I've also had a chance to visit there a couple of times, and what a gem the university has up in there.
It's a terrific place, Madam Chair, Representative Nornes, and our College of Biological Sciences uses it as part of their freshman orientation activity, and we get a lot of use out of that. Relative to the new building up there, I believe you've seen it.
Yes, I have. And I saw the groundbreaking and the building, so it was up there twice. One other additional piece, I think there's a facility in Otter Tail County that the University of Morris has been working with, the Eco Center, I think they call it that, and maybe that could be added, a little dot on the map here, too, right in the corner of Otter Tail County. It's for the future.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi, Representative Nornes. Indeed, that ecosystem was a eco-station, was a gift to the University of Minnesota a few years ago, and we're in the process of both standing up the programming and the facilities to make that a reality, but we'll add it to the map.
And President Kaler, in your new role, you're welcome to come and visit. We'll make sure that, we'll bring coffee and donuts out there, actually, even though there's no electricity yet. But
Representative Bernardi and Representative Nornes, I will appreciate the effort. Otter Tail County is a beautiful place, and we'll bring both fishing pole and golf clubs at my new life.
You can do all of that there. So thank you very much, and I look forward to your retirement, but I know that the future is good.
Thank you.
And I know the university will be in good hands as it goes forward with who you leave in charge.
Thank you, Representative Nornes. And I think our members can do a lot of quality control on this map because they really care about the things happening that the University of Minnesota is doing in their communities. So it's very obvious, and we're very proud of that. So members, please get the information to the JD, and we will make sure that that information gets back and the university can discern if that ought to be added to the map or not. So thank you, members. Representative Lehman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know if this is for President Kaler or for Mr. Burnett, but when I'm looking at the kind of the spheres here of the campuses, it's sort of like University of Minnesota, Twin Cities is the sun, and then you've got some medium-sized planets, smaller planets out there in the system. And Duluth is one of the, you know, obviously larger campuses right after Twin Cities. And I'm from Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Minnesota, and my most of my familiarity with the U of M comes from my familiarity in working with UMD. Mm-hmm. And one of the things, the question I have for you relates to tuition. And one of the things I hear from some of the teachers, instructors at UMD is that they've sort of fallen behind as it relates to the percentage of their costs that are covered by tuition. I'm hearing numbers like 80% of their costs are covered by tuition. So my question to you is, when you kind of spread the money around the system, do you look at that at all, about fairness of in your different campuses, of what percentage is tuition covering versus other revenues that might be coming from the budget?
Mr. Burnett.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi and Representative. We do. We look at the earning capability for each of our academic units, and there's not one that's like another in the sense that at one end of the spectrum, our business school here in the Twin Cities, the Carlson School of Management, has very strong demand. And numbers I was just sharing with the President a few hours ago, about 7% of its costs are covered by the state and 93% are covered by tuition. And I would submit to you, I showed also the President at his request some data from 2008 when the downturn and the state had to cut budgets to the university and to Minnesota State, where those O&M, the state O&M versus tuition sits for all of our academic units. And every one of our academic units, except for one, has less O&M as a percentage of their budget 10 years later than they did back in 08, including the Carlson School and every other academic unit, Morris, Crookston, Rochester, College of Science Engineering. There's only one that has more, and that's the medical school, because the legislature funded our medical discovery teams, things that were part of MnDrive, so the medical school, and it's very expensive to train doctors. It's very highly expensive, and we have one of the highest tuitions for the medical school in the country. So the Duluth campus, no question, has felt that as well. We continue to work with them as they get their budget more tuition-based and a little bit less state. But they've actually come up in the last couple of years. We've actually targeted resources to help them come up. The other thing we've done is try and create some separation in the tuition rates of the Twin Cities from Duluth and our other campuses, because the market for the Twin Cities campus, I believe, is different than the market for Duluth. Their competitive landscape's different. So for a long time, we had the same tuition rate across all five campuses. And working with the board, for Minnesota residents, we're starting to put a little gap between to help Duluth be more competitive. So we didn't raise tuition last year in-state at Duluth, while we did on the Twin Cities campus by inflation. So I think there's a number of strategies we're working with Duluth on. And, candidly, part of the $87 million request would be to help grow the O&M as a percentage of Duluth and help them be less tuition dependent than they are today. There's no question a piece of that's targeted for that. But it's also a challenge our law school had, as the President noted about the law school. It used to have a different market of how much they could command in the legal market. The applications for law school dropped from 100,000 to like 40,000 across the U.S. just because the legal environment's changing, so much is being automated and that type of thing. So each one of our units faces unique challenges in terms of competition, and we try to take that into account when we put their budgets together. And we continue to work with Duluth as they're being reformatted to a different mix between state support and tuition.
Representative Lane, yes, do you have a follow-up?
Yes, just quickly. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Britt, thank you for that great answer. I just would encourage you to continue to work with University of Minnesota Duluth. It seems like they're always struggling, really struggling financially. And so it's good to hear that you aren't treating all the campuses the same and you're looking at maybe a little differential in tuitions. Is the increase that you're looking at across the board, will it be the same percentage increase at all campuses?
No.
Mr. Bennett.
Madam Chair, Representative, no, it would not. I mean, some have the ability to generate tuition to help cover their costs, mm-hmm, that other units don't. And so it won't be, there's not a, again, we try to help all of them be successful, and they all face different challenges at different times. The Morris campus has different challenges than the Duluth campus does, and that now 20% of their students are American Indian, and by treaty don't pay tuition. So we have to make that up for the Morris campus, and that's something that none of our other four campuses have to work through. So I think what I would share with you is, again, from our perspective, we try to help them all be successful, and we look at all of their different abilities to generate revenue, and we are clearly focused on Duluth. I've been up there many times, sat down with their staff. It is a continuing focus. I would say the law school and Duluth right now are two of our top areas we're working on getting to where they need to be financially.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks. Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I wanted to, the only other time I guess I've spoken to Dr. Kaler was at the Governor's Mansion, gosh, maybe 8 years ago, and we talked about technology transfer. And I'm curious and very interested in that subject, and I'm just wondering what the status of commercializing the technology at the U is, and does your revenue source graph, does it reflect, I mean, where does it reflect any dollars that are coming into the university through that system?
President Kaler.
Chair Bernardi, Representative, first let me take the opportunity to realize that I should not give you numbers off the top of my head at my advanced age. The CSE enrollments, the total enrollment is 88,178, and of that, the undergraduate enrollment is 5,472. So I was close but not right in my answer to your previous question. As to technology transfer, that is a shining jewel at the university. We have a pretty sophisticated and effective way to take faculty inventions, run them through a set of processes that establishes the rigor of the invention, the potential market, and ensures appropriate protection of the intellectual property. We have a very small venture fund that allows us to provide some key bridging money that enables some additional experiments to be done that would generate a second patent that would broaden and expand the impact of the invention, for example. And we have a team of people that help people start up companies. So a typical number over the past 5 years is probably an average of 17 or 18 startup companies a year emerging from the university. A large fraction of those are still in business, which is relatively unusual in that space and is a testament to the rigor that we put the ideas through before we let them out as companies. Some of those companies license technology from the university. Some we may have an equity position in some of those companies in which we will realize a benefit if that company, if and when that company either goes public or is sold. And we generate a revenue stream each year. And I think Vice President Burnett is going to, it's inside that pie chart of University of Minnesota revenue sources. Unrestricted, and I will ask Ms. Donaldson if she has a number off the top of her head.
It's about $15 million per year. So it's a very small sliver of that pie. When you consider out of $3.8 billion, Madam Chair, if I can,
yes,
it's about $15 million a year. And under board policy, some of that goes back to the inventor and the college that sponsors that inventor. And then a piece of it goes to our Office of Tech Commercialization to reduce the cost of tuition and state support for running that office of tech transfer. So, but it is, you know, it's one area we're very proud of. We're actually in the top 15 of U.S. research universities in terms of licensing income coming back to the university. And obviously we'd like to continue to grow that as another piece of revenue, but it's a pretty small sliver in the overall scheme of funding the university, but one that's very important to us.
And, Madam Chair, to finish, that income is also a bit lumpy. It varies from year to year, as you might expect, and we are have only now the memory of a substantial revenue source, which comes from a different way. The federal government in 1981 passed the Bayh-Dole Act, which gave universities the ownership of intellectual property for inventions created using federal funding. And so one of our faculty members, Bob Vinson, generated a drug called Zyogen that became one-third of the anti-AIDS treatment cocktail. It was manufactured by Glaxo and generated roughly $600 million in licensing revenue over about a 15-year period to the University of Minnesota. But unfortunately, patents expire, and we no longer have that revenue stream.
Madam Chair, if I could just one quick additional question. I really would love to have more time to get more information. I don't even have a book here. Do we get another,
Representative Runbeck, we did bring a box of books that were left over from last time down. Are there any of those books left? Oh, it's the same one we had before. You might want to.
Okay.
Oh, We can get another one. Yes, but you may have one in your office.
Okay. All right.
Okay. Great. Representative Runbeck, do you have a follow-up question?
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just wanted to get some trend information on graduation rates, numbers that you're graduating, and what that trend is looking like.
Madam Chair, Representative, first off, we would be delighted to take time outside of this meeting room to go over any element that you'd like to know more about, and we would welcome you on campus to do that at your convenience, or we can come to you. Our graduation rates are a really terrific story. Our four-year graduation rate at the undergraduate level next year will tip above 70%. We believe projecting what will happen at other schools, that will give us the second highest four-year graduation rate of any public Big Ten university, following only Michigan. Northwestern, of course, as a private school, has a higher graduation rate. And that's a trend of improvement that's extended over at least 20 years and represents a remarkable statement to earlier questions about the efficiency and the quality of what we do. A place that is not getting better each year doesn't see increased graduation rates, so we're quite proud of that indicator.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you. And we did get a book over to you, Representative Runbeck.
Okay, thank
you. We're borrowing and sharing during this committee. Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi. Dr. Kaler, I'd just like to thank you. I've been around this building for a while, and during your tenure, I think you really led the ship in a good direction. You've been accessible. I haven't really been on this committee, but you've been around, and I've seen you talking to other members, and you'll stop for a millisecond for a question on a busy day even, and I just want to say that I appreciate that and respect that. I know that your government relations team has been much improved in my mind in the last few years too, and I'm grateful for that and can answer the deeper questions. But I know it's a complex job that you have, and I just can't even imagine. You know, I listen to the news and watch sports, so you got that component you haven't even mentioned today, so what a mess that must be. And then you've got Duluth doing so well, and then the Gophers doing so bad, so I don't know how you manage that, and then these St. Cloud people. So, but anyways, sorry to get light on that, but it's, I've been lucky, and Representative Poppy, and I think Representative Runbeck, and I don't know who else is, Representative Lehman, were you on Capital Investment? We've been lucky to be on all these campuses, and, you know, it really adds a neat perspective, because you really do get attached, you know, when you actually walk the grounds and you see them firsthand, you know, versus a piece of paper. And especially for us metro folks, and I got to be honest, I grew up, you know, my family kind of went to private schools in the state of Minnesota and Iowa and that sort of thing, but you're doing a great job, and these institutions are amazing, and the products are incredible, and our MNSCU system as well, I mean, is an amazing system, but I was happy to look through this, and I have been, you know, trying to do my homework as best I can, but I love how you're meeting the challenges for the changing world, and I personally really like a lot of the first-time students, you know, when you, you know, I've been lucky in my family because I was basically told I'm going to college, but, you know, that isn't everybody's experience, and we need, you know, our future generations, especially in Minnesota, to succeed and to thrive and to do well, and so that I just love to see your strong numbers on the first-time students, and you know, and then to go to graduation. If you haven't been to a graduation at even 2 years, you know, just on, the first year and the pride is just incredible to see, you know, probably more than, I think it was more shock when I graduated, I think, in my family. But it was, you know, it was pretty neat, like the first time. And the minority students to see, and I'm glad you're working on your diversity numbers. We had a presentation from Augsburg College, and actually they're probably doing the best of any of our institutions in Minnesota with reaching minority students. So hopefully you and your the next president will take a look at what they're doing and work on that. But my experience at the U hasn't been that strong. I don't know. I'm glad you turned around the beer numbers at the stadium. That was my big legislative achievement, getting beer at the Gopher Stadium with Tommy Rukavina. And but I think you lost money the first year, so you figured that out. So that's I'm proud of that, which I don't even drink, which I always think is pretty funny. So anyways, I just want to talk briefly, and I, you know, some of our DFL teams already heard this, but I'm familiar with your chemistry department a little bit, and my son's gone through it. I just happened to see this on my desk today, and I don't know how it got there, but it's pretty neat stuff with all these other schools. And Dr. Tolman, I think, isn't with you anymore, but he's a U, wasn't he, you know, at the U, and then now Reinecke. And I've mentioned this kind of our team, but with the diversity, they're really reaching out, like Dr. Reinecke is really reaching out to women and minorities. And when you get in these departments, it's just really neat to see. Like, my son was a student, as you know, and he's pretty Caucasian. But it's such a neat, diverse group, and that's you're building the future, and it was just really neat to see that you're doing that, and so these people, and they leave, and they go out, and some are staying in Minnesota, and like my son was able to get a job, so that's kind of neat, and then, but others are just going out and just getting on, hired on, but you're really doing I think that's just one piece of the pie, a small one, but it's, I just want to thank you for the work, and I think a lot of neat things that are going on if you actually dig deep. And I'm a little bit with Representative Cleavorn. I'd like to see a lot more money spent on our, you know, figuring that out, how to get more to you and then at the other levels of higher ed as well. So, anyways, thank you.
Thank you. Okay.
Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a couple of questions, but first, thank you for being here and for all this information that you provided us. I was wondering, Vice President Burnett, you said that the tuition waiver in Morris was by treaty. Can you tell me a little bit more about that? It's not my understanding that it's in a treaty, but maybe I'm misinformed.
Mr. Burnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Gomez, the history of the Morris, it was an Indian boarding school.
Yeah.
And so when it became state property, it was two locations in the country, one in Durango, Colorado, called Fort Lewis, and one called the University of Minnesota Morris, that Native American or American Indian students would have tuition free as part of that exchange that was set up between the state of Minnesota and the tribal nation. So it's a long-standing treaty that we honor by not charging tuition to American Indian students, and that doesn't mean just American Indian students from Minnesota. It could be American Indian students from any state.
So, but when you use the term, oh, excuse me, Madam Chair, thank you. Vice President Burnett, when you use the term treaty, though, like, I mean, you don't have to be a, it's a treaty describes a government-to-government relationship between two sovereign nations. It's mentioned in the Constitution as the supreme law of our land. And so I just want us to be careful about language, because I think that it's in state statute that there's a tuition waiver granted, and it's not, you mentioned that it's not to only to tribal residents or tribal members or descendants from Minnesota, but to anyone across the country. And so since a treaty does describe that government-to-government relationship, I don't think that's the right term.
Mr. Burnett.
I believe I may have misspoken, but that Congress also weighed in on this issue. It wasn't just the Minnesota legislature. There's an act of Congress that took place at the beginning of the 1900s, right in that. We can get you the data on it, but it forms an agreement between a nation, a sovereign nation, and a nation, but we can get you the details on that.
Yeah, I would like that.
But we honor that, and it become, it, right. My point in the question was it's a different challenge than our Duluth campus has in terms mm-hmm. of funding the educational needs of our students.
Yeah.
Representative Gomez, do you have a follow-up?
Thank you. I wanted to add a couple other questions, if that's okay, Madam Chair.
Yeah, follow-up.
Okay, thank you for that. I appreciate it. I just wanted to clarify that. So I wonder if you can... I admit that I haven't read all the entire book, I'm sorry to say. I was a better student when I was at the U, I swear. So I'm just wondering if you have information, maybe it's in here and I haven't encountered it, about the your contracting and like kind of as an enterprise and about your participation in the DBE program, how many, you know, they call it minority-owned firms. I don't think it's like the preferred nomenclature in our communities, but like, you know, people of color and women-owned firms.
President Taylor.
Madam Chair, I believe Representative Gomez has. Is that? Have you found what?
No, that's. She's showing the employee data, so
okay.
That's a little different.
We. I'm actually not sure, Madam Chair, Representative Gomez, that is in this book, but we certainly have it, and we can share it with you. I think our track record is pretty good, and it certainly has improved as we diversify our supplier source. That's an important thing for us to do.
Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That would be great. I would appreciate that information. The other thing I'm interested in, I guess, is about I think that I've heard people in my community express concern about the university being increasingly inaccessible to, I guess I'm trying to formulate the question right. I'm kind of interested in like how many kids from Minneapolis and St. Paul public schools apply, how many get in, how much is our land grant institution, especially, you know, I'm a Minneapolis rep, so I'm concerned with this Twin Cities campus, but it would be interesting to see the corollary data for the other sites about, you know, how many of our public school kids are applying and getting in, and what that kind of relationship is, especially as the university, I think, has, you know, kind of become more selective over time.
Sure.
President Kaler.
Chair Bernardi, Representative Gomez. We of course, have that data. We have granular data by high school, and so we can share that. With you, I'll tell you on a gross level that 70% of the undergraduates are Minnesota high school graduates across the system. On the Twin Cities campus, I think this year that number is about 64% of our undergraduates. And I will remind the committee that we have a very interesting relationship with Wisconsin and tuition reciprocity that allows Wisconsin students to come to Minnesota with in-state rates. Not every state has that, and as a result, we have about 14% of our student body from Wisconsin. And were they to be treated as non-resident tuition-paying students, that number would probably be lower. The revenue would probably be higher, and the space for Minnesota residents would probably also be higher. It's an interesting arrangement we have.
Thank you, Dr. Kaler. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Thank you. That was the extent of our questions, and so I have questions as well.
Yes, ma'am.
I was crossing them out as we went, and I only crossed out one, unfortunately, so I have some additional questions. One is, We're getting some requests from for University of Minnesota programs and departments for research and those sorts of things that I believe are coming outside of this budget. Can you just give us a little history on that? How you look at those? Is it your strategy? Is it, you know, can you tell us, are you, do you frown on those? You tell them not to do this, but they do this? So I want to know how to educate our committee to be able to know your position on that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a couple of humorous analogies, which I will not put on the record for you. We do not encourage, we actively discourage individual end runs around our process to you. I think that's confusing, frankly, to the committee. It would be confusing to me were I in your shoes. And it also could quickly become chaotic and does not allow us to identify the priorities that the institution has. Not every individual with a good idea understands that that support for that could well be carried out within the $87 million request that we have in front of you should it be fully funded. So I would encourage you to ask your staff and members to simply funnel those requests back through our government relations offices, J.D. Burton in particular, and we will continue to communicate to folks that they need to work within a coherent system. Otherwise, you won't have a basis to identify what the university priorities are, and I would presume those would be of interest to you primarily.
Okay, thank you very much. My next question is regarding reserves. How does the University of Minnesota manage their reserves, and how does that play into the next year's budget and tapping into tuition reductions or freezing tuition? How do you manage the reserves in each of the departments, and how do you apply that to the mission and vision of the university?
So, Madam Chair, I'll ask Vice President Burnett to amplify my comments, but mine are twofold. One is that we're a $4 billion a year business. A $4 billion a year business should have a certain number of days cash on hand just as a matter of doing what we do. Income to the university is also a bit lumpy. We receive substantial tuition payments, obviously, in the early fall and early spring, and not very many tuition payments in July. So there are reserves needed to maintain the operation of the university. And the number of days cash on hand is one of the three critical parameters that determine our bonding rating that enable us to go into the capital markets to fund construction activity. The number is probably a little bit under $1 billion right now, 25% of the annual budget. That's a very prudent set of reserves for an institution of our size to have. It certainly sounds like a lot of money that we should just instantly be able to use, but we run a business that's been in business for 160-plus years, and we intend to keep it that way, and a healthy cash flow reserve is critical for that. Vice President Burnett?
Just a couple things to echo, if I can, Madam Chair. We have $1.4 billion of long-term debt that's been issued by the regents, and servicing that debt and having the AA1 credit rating that we have depends on us having adequate reserves to cover those debt service payments, which approach about $100 million a year. So it's critical that Moody's and Standard & Poor's see that we have cash on hand to do that. That said, most of these reserves are held by the medical school or the other schools out there, and they're differential. Our law school at present has zero reserves, which is some of the things we're having to work with them on, because in the downturn, their reserves were exhausted. So it's not a one-size-fits-all. It's something the administration looks at unit by unit to see that they're not don't have too much, but also have enough to withstand a shock or at least something like that. But overall, as President Kaler said, we need cash on hand for payroll that is lumpy. We're very grateful that the state appropriation comes in 1/12 increments. It's probably our most assured piece of state of funding of our unrestricted dollars. But it's absolutely critical to our credit rating that we have reserves that can cover our outstanding debt obligations, and it is one of the reasons we have one of the strongest credit ratings of any university in the country.
Okay, thank you. My question was, how do you manage that? And that's you gave me enough information, but it was, do you manage that, and how does that system work? And so it sounds like you have a good handle on that? Is it system-wide?
Yeah. Excuse me, Representative Bernard, we do meet with each unit on their reserves and what levels those are. Those are also like savings accounts. And so what we have to guard against is using those for recurring costs when they're one time, right? And some of them are actually saving up for a piece of equipment or startup costs for a new faculty member, and it might take them a couple of years for a department to save up enough to attract a competitive faculty hire to come to the university. So a lot of those are just, there's a million stories for each one of those reserves because they're distributedly held across this vast $4 billion enterprise. But we do meet with each unit on it annually, centrally, and talk with it about where their reserves sit.
Mm-hmm. And Sir Bernardi, if I may, a couple of additional facts. You might remember the federal government shut down and that suspended the flow of research funds to the university. Our research spending on federal funds is approximately $500,000 a day. So we incurred $10 million of expenditure. We made a choice to use reserves to fund that in anticipation of reimbursement by the federal government, which we will almost certainly get, versus the alternative of stopping research projects, which we think would have been irresponsible. The other element, Vice President Burnett mentioned savings. As you know, when the state funds a building, typically the state funds two-thirds of that amount, university funds one-third. Well, units accumulate the money that will be used for that one-third in reserves, again, over a period of years in order to be able to achieve that capital expenditure, and that's how the business works.
Thank you very much. And then I have two questions. One is, I remember getting district information of our districts. Do you still do that, and have we gotten those this year, or do we have them? Oh, it's in here? Did we just get that today? Oh, good. Thank you very much.
It's very fresh data,
yes,
Madam Chair.
It's very helpful. I appreciate that. And then the next question is, and we only have like 3 minutes, but when you guys have a huge budget, how do you manage making sure that the integrity of that it's being spent properly, that there's not like, oh, let's hurry and spend our budget at the end of the year so make sure we get the budget the next year. How do you put systems in place to help make sure that the dollars are being spent super wisely, and how do you get your arms around that?
I'll again ask Vice President Burnett, but I'll take 30 seconds with a story. The National Science Foundation periodically audits research expenditures. We are a very large federal, eighth largest public research university in the country, so the NSF came to audit us recently. And typically the disagreement between the auditor's findings and what the university may think is okay can be $10 million. In some cases it could be $25 or $30 million in disagreements. We completed our NSF audit, and while the results are not complete, we currently have a dispute after hundreds of millions of dollars of expenditures, over $98,000. And we are pretty sure we're actually right. So the quality and fidelity of the accounting systems and the checks and balances with internal audit and external audit is as robust here as I've ever seen in my career.
Excellent. Thank you.
And I would just echo what President Kaler said. Madam Chair, we have a robust internal audit division, about 18 staff, and the chief auditor reports to our Board of Regents, does not report to President Kaler. And that's best practices, particularly in the last two decades in governance. We also can do our own internal audit. We do other ways of checking on the expenditures and that type of work and look at that. But it is something that we continually look at. And back to the reallocation process, when we see something that could be done better or cheaper in a different way, we challenge units that could be part of their reallocation solution to put that money to a higher and better use. So I think that just the $90 million exercise over the last 6 years, and let me just say, we're building next year's budget with another $10 million of reallocations, in addition to the $87 million we're asking for, in addition to the tuition increase we will be proposing to the Board of Regents for their consideration. We're not done looking for ways to do things better, and that challenges our managers to think about how they staff and run their and support their students maybe in a more efficient way.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate you you present, you all, not you guys, you all presenting, you all, yeah, I'm trying, becoming Southern now, I'm trying to use you all, for presenting today and for the work you do to educate our state and to our economic engine and the community engagement you do across the state. I appreciate it, and the meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm.